our main speaker, Charlie C. from Ojai.
Hi, I'm Charlie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Charlie.
And I'm from Camarillo, which is $3.7 million south of Ojai. And I would like to thank Lee for inviting me. Lee and I have been friends for a long time, and I love him, and I love his enthusiasm for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really admire people who are enthusiastic because they're hard to come by anymore. And when you get older, it's hard to drum up enthusiasm too, because why bother? So, sloppy, sloppy, sloppy. I too have potato-like sobriety. My friend Jack, Jack and I got sober at the same time, and it was so good to see him. So we got a lot of catching up to do, so good to see you, man. And Jim, what a great talk. Jim and I graduated the same year from high school, went to Cal State, we're 49ers, right? And the one thing you learn about the Cal State Long Beach campus is this: you can have morning classes at the lower campus, and then there's a big hill to the upper campus. And midway between the upper campus and the lower campus is a bar on this campus, and it's called the Nugget. If you're alcoholic, you'll never get to your upper classes. You can try, but when you pass the Nugget, it's like Odysseus going past the sirens, you know, lash me to the mast, men. I don't want to dive into the water after them. Once you get up there and you smell the Nugget and you hear the Nugget, you're in the Nugget. So, thank you. Not all that's out of the way. I'm Barbara, thank you for coming with me. It makes the drive sweeter, and we have such a good time. Anyway, reading chapter, my story is like a pinball machine. You know, you just drop a quarter and you watch things bounce around, and events seem to happen at weird times. So just give me a moment. Reading chapter 5, when you give, you want to terrorize an alcoholic, give them one of the steps like you did. We have the round robin step reading during chapter 5 and watch them sweat. Especially the ones that I hate that stuff. They come up and go, Charlie, would you read? You read the 10th step during the chapter 5 reading. And I think, now I'm not going to hear anything. I'll just sit there the whole time going, okay, that's 2. I have 10. That's 2. That's 3. I've got 3, and I've got 10. I've got 10. Was that 4? Did he say 4? Yeah. The whole time till it gets up to 10, and I pray that I read what I've, and I pray I don't jump in before somebody else. I'm really sick. Like after number 8, I just jump in because I'm nervous. And I used to, went in sobriety when my children were little. When my son was little, we used to go to this thing called Daddy and Me. They had a Mommy and Me. I don't know if they have that up here. It's where you take your kids. Mothers can take their kids there like 3 times a week, and dads get to take them once a month. And you go on a Saturday, and the dads would go, and there's like, in my group, there were 29 dads. And you go, and you sit in a circle in this big room with your child sitting there with you, and you sing, I don't know, 30, 40 verses of Wheels on the Bus, and then you hand your child over to some stranger, but we don't know who they were or what they were doing with our children, but we were ready to go where the donuts were, you know, over in this little Quonset hut. So all of us trek over to the Quonset huts, and our kids are all left to be with the serial killer in the next room. We get over there, and the facilitator was apparently a kindergarten teacher who spoke just like this. And everything was addressed to us just like this. And all of us were looking around at each other like, what is it? You know, and she goes, okay, what I want you to do is I want you to go around the table, and I want you to say your name and tell us what you do for a living so we get to know each other. Well, now I'm going, I'm going to say I'm an alcoholic. I know what you're saying. Now I can't hear anybody else's name. I was like, I'm going around, I'm David, and I do this for a living, and I'm thinking, don't say you're, do not say you're an alcoholic. Do not. Don't say it. Just halfway around the table, it gets to me. I'm Charlie, and I work, and I told him right where I worked. I was so relieved. Was, oh, God. And it gets about four guys down. This guy goes, my name's Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. And five of us went, hi, Tom. That's, you really can't escape us. And if you're new and you think you're going to buy a bottle and we're not going to see you, we're going to go, hey, I met you Saturday night at the meeting. Good night. We're glad you're here. Welcome all the newcomers. I'm glad that you're here and joined us because this is a good group. This is, you can tell it, you can feel it. You can know a good group when you're seeing one because people don't distract each other from hearing the message, and everybody's interested in everybody else's well-being, and that's great. And they have coffee too, because if a speaker doesn't show up, nobody gives a damn. But if that coffee person doesn't show up, there's going to be a riot in here. People are going to be throwing these pews at each other, you know, and then tomorrow morning talking about spirituality. Anyway. So I'm an alcoholic. I hate people. As a species, not individually. I don't like humans particularly. That's why Jack and I hit it off from the first time we ever met, because I just do not like people. Not you. You gotta understand that you're exempted from this this judgment. But them. I mean, have you spent any time with them? I mean, they are complete waste of carbon. They are horrible, petty, grief, just hideous little things. They're the problem I have with them is I need their approval all the time. And it's exhausting because you can't stand them. You loathe them, in fact. But hey, wait a minute. Whoa, where are you going? Don't go away so soon. Yeah, I need your approval. But get away from me. That's too close. And oh, whoa, where are you going? Where are you? And it's like a slinky. It goes back and forth. You know, the emotional slinky. And it's confusing, and it creates conflict, and it always has for me. I've always felt that way. I didn't like people, and you know, I don't want to end this talk with you walking out of here going, he hates people just like I do. I like AA. They hate people. That's not the case. And I realized later on, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, is that I just wanted to be part of things, and I never felt like I was a part of anything. And when you don't feel like you're a part of something, and it's not what anybody did to me. No one ever isolated me from people, or I was bullied a little bit when I was in middle school, but I beat the living hell out of this guy and that ended that. But I was scared for my life, you know. My father told me he'd back me up if I punched a bully, and I told the same thing to my son. But anyway, I wanted to be a part of something, and I just never felt like there was a way I could do that. My father was he had a fifth grade education. He was a Marine Corps, he was a drill instructor in the Marine Corps. He spent 8 years in the Marine Corps, and he went into World War II in the Pacific. And my mom was a housewife, and she worked for the phone company, and they met in San Francisco and got married. And my mom had three other babies besides me, they were all born dead, except for me, of course. And much to my dismay, I know it's hilarious, but we'll swap some dead baby jokes after the meeting, maybe. I always wondered why it was me. You know, I didn't ask to be born. I don't want to be in this world. I don't fit in into anything. I was gangly. I had asthma. I wheezed a lot. My father, I was sure, was disappointed in me because he was a Marine, you know, and here I am, wheezing, and the eighth dwarf, wheezy, and I was sure that I'd been a disappointment to him, And I just felt shabby all my life. You know, we didn't have a whole lot of resources. And so I always felt obviously out of tune with everybody else. And I had nothing going for me except my potential, which I had in abundance. I think alcoholics have a lot of potential. I'm sure most of us are still at about 90% right now of potential. I didn't realize until much later after I got sober that they don't tell people they've got potential if they're using their potential. They only tell it to us. You know? And I can't tell you how many times I was called into an office with my parents, you know, my poor suffering parents, with me, wheezy, sitting in the chair and having some administrator or some counselor or some priest or somebody open up a big cumulative folder and go, And looking at my parents are just, what? You know, because neither of them graduated from high school. And they go, you know, they shut the notebook and go, Charles has a lot of potential. We just don't understand why he doesn't do anything with it. And my response was always the same. It was, look, I know I've got potential. You clearly know I've got potential. Now my parents both know I've got potential, and I know I've got potential. I just want you to know that I will use my potential when I'm damn good and ready to use it. And not even that much sooner, because when I use my potential, I suggest you have sunglasses on, Skipper, because I'm going to light you up. But until then, you might want to take your idiotic concern for my potential and go wipe it on some other sap, because if you were such hot stuff, you wouldn't be a high school counselor, would you? It never came out in exactly those words. I usually said something like, I'll try harder. But and I realized at that point, I'm a rebel by nature. I just don't tell anybody. I'm a secret rebel. You'll all laugh till I show up with a detonator, you know? That's how I think. But I graduated from high school with my potential flag flying, and I went right in the music industry. I was working as a clerk at a record store, and I was working there. And some of the guys I went to high school with, as Jim was out being a big success, I was working at a record store, and these guys came in and asked me if I wanted to go to a party. Now, I didn't want to go to a party because people party. No, I'm not going to go to the party. I said, okay. And so I got my buddy John, who's my best friend, and he was a drummer in a band. And I thought if I went with him and he drove, I'd probably catch some of the girl runoff, you know, because I was not exactly a chick magnet like I am now. But I and so I went to this party on Saturday night in Santa Ana, California. I was living in Orange County and I went to high school down there. And there I was at the party with my friend John. We walked in. It was an old Victorian house. There were probably 200 kids in there. I just turned 18 the month before. It was November of 1968. And I went into this party and thought, oh my God. I have never seen such a collection of ferret-faced little bastards in my whole life. Look at these people. Hippies. I couldn't stand. I didn't like my parents' generation. Man, I hated me some hippies. And I just didn't want to be there. They were all phonies. They all spoke in that philosophy 101 talk that we used to talk in, you know. And they were all Sears hippies, too, which I don't know. People my age don't remember what a Sears is. They became hippies when the clothing was available at Sears. Now I'll be a hippie. I can get it at Sears. And I just couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand it. And I walked into that party and it was just, oh man, why did I say I would come here? And I felt uncomfortable and separate, distant from people, like I always did. Like there was some, and not like there was a wall between us or some hardcore shell. It was like albumin. It was just this thing, this membrane that was over me that would not allow me to be really, to interact with anybody. I couldn't figure out the code, you know? And I knew that when I walked in that room, I knew that's gonna happen. Here it goes again. I don't know where to even start. And so I'm standing there perplexed, thinking, I want to get out of here. And I'd been there 5 minutes. And John, he wanted to have a good time. He went off someplace. And there I was. And somebody walked by and handed me, you know, a can of malt liquor, the people's brew. And so I knew I wasn't getting. I held this can of malt liquor. And here's what went through my head. My father's going to kill me if he finds out I drank a can of malt liquor. Because I'd never been drunk before. And then I thought, the Archbishop of the Archdiocese of Orange County is going to kill me because I took a pledge when I did my sacraments in the Catholic Church that I wouldn't drink till I was 21. So now I'm going to get excommunicated. So I got my father. This is all going through in about 3 seconds in my head. And my third thought was, I'm probably not going to get offered a Pepsi. And I cracked that thing open and drank it. And about halfway through that thing, it occurred to me right here that I've been way too hard on you people. I started to feel, you know, I mean, you wouldn't be here if you didn't know that sense of, unless you're Al-Anon and you want to find out, you know, but I laugh when Jim said, what kind of girl wants to drink with it, wants to dance with a drunk guy? I want to say, show of hands? There'll be a couple of you in here. I was unhappy, but when I drank that can of malt liquor, everything just kind of fell away. All of that stuff I talked about, the separation, all of that went somewhere, and I felt connected. A lot of people, and I've heard this, and I believe them. I believe the story when people say they drank to get out of reality, to get out of the world. When I drank, it made me feel like I was a part of the world for a change. I was there for a change. Instead of wondering how to get there, I was there. And I was better looking. I was witty. I was clever. I was smart. I liked you. I was attractive. Like, you know, my eyes are up here, girls. Attractive. You know that. Or single line, ladies, there's plenty here for everybody. No shoving. That didn't work out, but I was 6'2" and this quivering vessel of testosterone, and with nowhere to go. I was like a chihuahua chasing a school bus, you know? What are you gonna do when you catch it, you know? And I start barking, and but I felt like something had transformed me the first time I drank. And I know it doesn't happen with a lot of people. I know it goes through, some people have, you know, invisible line they cross. I heard a guy when I was new who said the invisible line was his mouth. When he drank, that was the invisible line between him and alcoholism. And so I just felt, I felt fulfilled. I'd never felt that way before. I felt like something had become more powerful in my life that made me feel like I'd found a secret and I'd found some understanding that I hadn't had before. And I wanted to feel that way all my life. And it wasn't like a big conscious decision either. It was just something that I made note of. And later that evening, as I was coming out of a blackout, because you can't pay the rent to stay there on one can of malt liquor, I was running alongside of John's car. He wanted to leave. I was holding onto his door handle. He had this old Volkswagen. I was throwing up all over myself and laughing my butt off because I'd been to the mountaintop and I'm not going back. I don't know what it was that happened, but I want to do this again really soon because I feel I've unlocked something here. And my drunk log doesn't get any better than that. You know, it gets to be humiliating. I wasn't laughing at the end. But I don't have a jump out of the car yelling, you pigs aren't going to take me alive kind of drunk log. I wish I did. Never come out of a blackout yelling, call for backup. I've heard those stories. They're great. I've heard, you know, people coming out of blackouts going, cover me, I'm going in. Holy, I never came out of blackout with saying anything. I've come out of blackouts with people saying things to me like, well, I bet that hurt. As far as me whispering or yelling anything to get anybody to line up behind me. That didn't work out. But I wanted to be a writer, because athletics were certainly out of my realm. And I got a job at a bookstore, which seemed logical. You want to be a writer? Get a job at a bookstore. You lift enough books and stock enough shelves, you're going to be a writer. And I married a woman who was a clerk at the bookstore. I was 24, she was 23, and we got married, and we kind of pooled her resources, and we got a nice apartment, and she had the only problem she really had was she wanted a husband, and I had no idea. I had no idea how to be a husband. On our honeymoon, we spent our honeymoon in Carmel, which is a romantic town, and especially for two young people in their 20s. And her dad got us this great hotel room there in the Highlands, you know. And after dinner, the first night we were there, went back to the room, and I said, you know, I'll be back in a little bit. I'm gonna just run downtown and have a drink. Because she knew how I drank. Her brother, his name was Bob, he was my age at the time, and the first time I met him, you know, she prepped me for meeting him. She said, Bob drinks a lot, and he's been in sanitariums, and he's been in hospitals and stuff, so don't drink when he's here. Just let him, we're trying to keep him on the straight and narrow. Okay, no problem. Yeah, so Bob came over, and I had a bottle of bourbon, and I said, do you want something to drink? And he said, yeah. I said, great, so do I. And I started pouring us drinks, and you know, an hour into it, we were halfway through that bottle of bourbon, and we're drinking, and we're listening to music, and we're laughing and scratching and having a great time. And I glance over, and there's his sister, my wife-to-be, standing at the door of the bedroom, giving me this, which is the international sign that you're not gonna get a compliment if you're a man, and a woman does this to you, forget it. So I go, excuse me, Bob. And I walk over to the bedroom, and she steps aside to let me in, and she shuts the door and said, stop giving Bob alcohol. Bob is an alcoholic. And I said, Bob is no more of an alcoholic than I am. The problem is that you're an egg, and you need to back off, sister. And I turned around and walked out of that bedroom, you know. And she started sobbing, of course, so we just turned up the stereo. And and not to curdle the milk much here, but 2 weeks later, Bob was dead. He went in, I think it was Lake Castaic or Lake Casitas, I don't know which one, but he went in and didn't come out, he drowned. He was a handsome, hale 25-year-old with a 5-year-old daughter and an estranged wife, and he was dead. And no one talked about alcoholism after that. It just wasn't a subject. And so anyway, I worked at that bookstore. It was a stepping stone job till I got my writing career going, and I got it going about 13 years later. But that's when I went to Cal State Long Beach, and held down the fort at the Nugget for a long time. But I got a degree in journalism, and I put that degree in a drawer and never did a thing. I stayed at the bookstore and worked there. Lisa, my then wife, said, if you need to go to therapy or this marriage isn't gonna work. And I thought, well, you know, therapy. I went with her to this therapist. We're gonna have couples counsel. And the therapist said, would you like to come see me by yourself? And I said, why? And she said, well, you might learn something about yourself. And I said, with a straight face, and I remember this, I said, there really isn't anything about myself that I don't already know. And she smiled and said, okay. And then when we got home, Lisa put down she threw the gloves down and said, you're either going to go to therapy or this is over. And so I went to therapy. The romantic that I am, I went to therapy. And therapy works for a lot of stuff. And if you need therapy, you should get therapy. But therapy doesn't work for alcoholism. A according to my experience. Because for therapy to work, the prerequisite is honesty. If you're an alcoholic in therapy, and you have a distant relative relationship with honesty. I know I did, because I built my entire life through drinking into this, what do you call it, scaffolding around myself. I built it around a condemned building, but I kept building the scaffolding and hanging, you know, the sign out front that says, coming soon. You know, that's what I was. I'm coming soon, folks. Keep your eye on this space. Pardon our dust. And I drank. And I drank till I was sick. And I drank till I couldn't drive. I'm a wall walking. You know, the wall is your friend if you're drunk like I am, because you have to put your hand against it to see where you're going until you find an opening. And then you peek in and see if it's your bed or not. And then just keep going if it's not. I'm a pants pissing, not fully peeing, enough to show. When I got to AA, when I was sober a few years, there was a woman in my group named Cuenca. And Cuenca talked about coming to AA in soaked, urine-soaked pajamas. And I thought, that's a little dramatic. You know, what constitutes that anyway? You know, and I started thinking about it, which you really shouldn't do. And like, how much is urine soaked? Or how, what does it even mean to wet your pants? And then I realized after some serious contemplation that I guess anything more than a quarter that shows, you pretty much wet your pants, you know? And but I was, that was happening. I was peeing blood at the end. I was driving drunk all the time, and in those days you could get pulled over by the police and they would come up. Usually the ways I got away was because they get a more higher priority call and take off, or they would take your keys from you and put them in the trunk of your car and shove the trunk and say, come back and get them tomorrow. You know, how am I supposed to get home? Well, you'll figure that out. And off they go. So any self-respecting drunk had a separate car key in his pocket, okay, in case, oh, I'm so sorry, officer. Oh, don't throw my keys in the trunk, officer. But I was getting sicker and sicker, and my therapist was throwing a meditation retreat one weekend in Montecito, and I decided to go to that. I didn't decide to go to that. I was compelled to go to that. And I was divorced now, and I've been living in a garage, a converted garage, a nice garage, not a bad garage, but, and I didn't like it there, so I moved in with my mom, you know, which is where most male alcoholics wind up at the end. Most of us wind up at our mom's house at some point. They should call recovery houses my mom's house. That way people won't be compelled to stay there for a year. You know, just get a job. If you're staying at Phoenix House, you know, you're going to stay because you can get the T-shirt and you're at Phoenix House. But nobody wants to stay at my mom's house. You don't want the T-shirt. You don't want the swag. You just don't want it. And so I'm living at my mom's house. But she moved out with her husband. She remarried and moved out with her husband. My dad died when I was 23. And so I went to this meditation retreat. I had a moment of clarity. Not going to go into a long story, but I felt like I wanted to kill myself there, which is certainly grounds for a refund at a meditation retreat, but certainly not. Like, why did you guys come here? I came here to find inner peace, and I came here to find a way to contemplate my life. And me, I came here to find out if this is a good place to commit suicide, you know, quite frankly. But I didn't commit suicide, and at the moment that I was seriously contemplating it, I felt something occur inside of me that was not a voice, but you understand it was like a voice that said, you are everything you fear. Because I was feeling despair like I'd never felt before, because I couldn't get anything going. I didn't know which way I was facing. I didn't know why I was getting sicker. I didn't know why I couldn't maintain friendships, why I lived this secret life of there's me in public and there's me drinking. And I was drinking at home all the time. I was saving up food for Armageddon in the in the hallway pantry. I was just nuts, and I went home from that meditation retreat, and that was the 11th of June of 1981, and that's the last time I've had a drink or anything. And I got home from there, and I didn't know what to do. And about three, I white knuckled it, and that was not going well. I was hearing voices in my car and having, you know, we get that, those imaginary gnats kind of zip into your peripheral vision and they hang there, you know, and you're looking, you can see them. No, you're talking to somebody and they're looking at you and you know they can see them, but they don't look like they can see them. So you just kind of just casually flip them away. And, looks like you're doing your imaginary hair, you know, and flipping these gnats away. And I forgot how to walk one day, and it was just not going well. And I got a call from my ex-mother-in-law, and she said, Debbie needs a ride home from a care unit that she's in for her to get sober. Can you give her a ride to an AA meeting? And I just told Sue, was my mother-in-law, I told Sue, you know, I quit drinking this week. I can pick her up. You know, I ran and got my cape put on. I was going to go save Debbie. And I went and picked her up, and we drove to the Sunday night meeting in Tustin. And on the way, in the 20 minutes it took to get from work, from the care unit to the meeting, she 12-stepped me. And she had 22 days of sobriety. And she passed the message along. And she told me that she really liked what the AA people had to say in this place she was. I didn't understand what it was. And so we pull up in front. I said, what time do you want me to come pick you up to take you home? And she said, well, why don't you come inside? Why don't you come in the meeting with me? And I said, because I'm not an alcoholic, you know? And, so... She said, that's okay because it's a speaker meeting, it's an open meeting and guests are welcome. So since you quit drinking this week, maybe you'll hear something that'll help you. And she didn't have enough experience in AA to even know to say that. But she said it and I heard it and I went in. I can't argue with that. I parked the car, went in there, hated AA. Everybody was so can do, you know. We got a book. Have you have a big book, Charlie? A big book? And my first thought was, how big a book are we talking about? I work in a bookstore and we got lots of big books in there. Perhaps your big book has a title. I didn't say that. I said, I don't think I do. And they gave me one for a special price because I didn't have enough money. And I was there at just the right time because the literature lady said, well, you know what, tonight it's only $2. I thought, what luck, things are starting out fine already, you know? I didn't know she said that to anybody who didn't have enough money to buy a big book. But what do you got? I had $3, and they were the three saddest looking dollar bills you've ever seen in your life. Like they had, in my hand, they looked like they had just given up. Yeah. And she goes, okay, well, you know, look, I'm going to take these two, okay? And the book is yours. Keep the book. If you want to buy somebody else a book at some point, do that. But you don't owe us anything. That other dollar, drop it in the basket when it goes around because nobody stays sober around here on somebody else's dime. And I said, okay. And when that basket went around, there were about 300 people as me. I had no idea where she was in the meeting, but I had that dollar bill up, and when I let it go, it went in slow motion as the basket was coming, you know, right into the basket. It was beautiful, and I was sure she was impressed, and I wish her well. I don't know where I was only there at that meeting for a few weeks. They made me a greeter. That was the peak of my success there. And the last person you want at an AA meeting is me as a greeter. They might as well have invited a mortician to come in there and greet people, you know. Oh, God, glad you're here. Buck up. It's all right. These people are crazy. And And I thought I was better than anybody else. I thought, I don't know if I have alcoholism. I don't know if I'm an alcoholic, you know? I pee a little blood. I'm peeing it now as we're talking, you know? So, but that doesn't make me an alcoholic. A guy convinced me, I heard Chuck Chamberlain speak twice before I even got a sponsor. And the first time I heard him, he spoke at the meeting I was going to. And I didn't know who he was. I didn't know what I didn't understand a word he said, honestly. And Chuck could light up a room, man. He was one of these guys who was full of life and full of enthusiasm. And he would thank the last person in line with the same enthusiasm that he thanked the first person in line. You know, and how did I know that? Because I was always the last person in line, just to see if they were phonies or not, you know. And I go swaggering up there, and thank you for coming out and speaking to our group. And he said, how long are you sober, boy? And I said, 20 days. And he said, oh, God, I love you. And he threw his arms around me, and he kissed me. And that's where I caught alcoholism. Chuck Chamberlain was a carrier. And I wound up getting to my home group, which is where I met Jack. And we were just happy campers there. And people kept saying, get a sponsor. And I thought, well, why do I need a sponsor again? Well, they'll walk you through the big book. Well, walk me through this deep metaphysical text with all these double meanings in it. I need somebody. I have a degree from Cal State Long Beach in journalism. I need somebody to walk me through the jaywalker analogy. Some pretty heavy lifting there. Or have somebody explain to me specifically what G-Ma ain't it grand the wind stop blowing means. Or why I should give a damn about Mr. Brown, you know? And if you don't know who Mr. Brown is, shame on you. But I got a sponsor just to shut everybody up, because they'd stop asking me if I had a sponsor. And so I got a sponsor, his name was Bill. He's my first sponsor. My second sponsor's name is Bob, and that wasn't planned at all. My current sponsor is Bob Regan. He lives in Oxnard. He's 58 years sober, and he's been my sponsor for the last 18 years. But Bill was my first sponsor, and Bill was a really friendly, kind guy. He's about 6'6", and big handshake, and friendly, and interested. He would pay attention. And so I said, would you be my sponsor? And he said, well, let's go out for coffee and talk about it. I thought, I don't get quality like this sauntering into AA, I'm sure. So we have to go talk about it, you know? That's what I'm thinking. I said, okay. And so we went out for coffee, and he said, are you willing to do anything to stay sober? And I said, yes. And I meant it. I was dead serious. And he said, well, there's some things I want you to do. Okay. I want you to get to meetings an hour early, and I want you to start shaking hands with everybody in the room and asking them their name. Oh, that's a bridge too far. You know, that's just not fair. I don't like people. I don't want to walk up and shake a stranger's hand and say, what's your name? That's weird. Okay. And I said, okay. And he said, I want you to get phone numbers from 10 of the men every night and start putting them in a little phone book that you carry, a phone thing that you carry around with you so you can call people. Because we didn't have cell phones then. Okay. I want you to get commitments at all your meetings. That means you take a job there that you keep and you show up for it like you would show up for a job, because there are people counting on you to be there. And in that way you can be useful and in service, and you'll understand why I want you to do that after you've been doing a commitment for a while. You'll get it. Okay. I think, what next? Is that it? No. I want you to call me every morning. And he was a milkman. He was up at 3 a.m. up with the cows, literally. And he would call me at 5 a.m. Yep, yet? I am now, you know, and And he, what are you gonna do today? Oh, and I tell him, and he go, okay, great, I'll see you at the meeting tonight. Click. And I'd go to work, and I'd try to pray in the morning. He said, oh, well, that was the next thing on his list. I want you to pray every day. I want you to get on your knees, and I want you to talk to a power that's bigger than you are. And I looked at him, and he goes, not God. I want you to talk to a power that's bigger than you are. And I said, isn't that code? He said, let me repeat this one last time. I want you to talk to a power anywhere that's bigger than you are. And in the morning, I want you to ask it to help you get through the day sober. And at night, I want you to thank it for your sober day. And pray for anybody that you can. I said, okay. And then he said, oh, and I'll see you at the men's stag on Friday. I said, yeah. And he said, I want you to shave that silly mustache off before you go. And I said, and he said, I know what you're thinking. I can see it on your face. You just said 30 seconds ago that you were willing to do anything to stay sober, right? And I said, yeah. And he said, I just asked you to shave your mustache off, right? I said, yeah. He said, if you're not willing to shave your mustache off just because I asked you to do it, what makes me think you're going to do these steps when I start getting you to do those? I just want to find out if you're a loser or not. I guess I'll know Friday. Bye. He got me walking out of the coffee shop before I could even get my finger up, you know. And so I did, you know what I did? I was desperate. And if you're here new tonight and you're not, and you are desperate, welcome to AA. We are desperate people who found a way to cope with desperation, and not only cope with it, but learn to live with it and to thrive within it and around it. And so I did everything he told me to do. I shook hands. I got phone numbers. I called people every day who would go politely go, who is this? I go, this is Charlie. I met you at the meeting last night. Ah, Charlie, good to hear from you. What's going on? Oh, I'm just working today. But and then he goes, you gonna be at the meeting tonight? Yeah, I'll see you there. I'll be look for you. Click, you know. And that was the extent of our phone call. And when I call other guys, but that was fine. I made friends in the group, and I still have my best friend from, you know, 43 years ago. And my life started to get better. My life started to change. Now, here's how it happened. I was feeling, because I'd been sober for a while, I'd been sober 8 months, and incidentally, happy birthday on a year. I don't believe in miracles. I don't think I'm a miracle, because if you get into that line of thinking, you wind up thinking, oh, these Kleenex, they're a miracle. I just don't believe I'm a miracle, but I believe there's one miracle that you see in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's when somebody new stays sober for a year. That's a miracle to me that anybody can stay sober for a year, because so much is going on in that year between my ears and between what everybody else is doing and between what I hope that I want and between that, and because of the temptation that alcohol presents to me as a workable solution. Why do I have to stack chairs when I can have two sips of bourbon and feel wonderful again for about 3 minutes, okay? I have to think all these things through. And when I got a year, I was almost exhausted from the end to the end of it, because I'd done an inventory. I didn't start making amends till I was after my first year, but I'd done my inventory. I read it to my sponsor. I did all the stuff he said, and it still didn't work for me. No, I didn't have a spiritual change. Nothing happened. I was so angry, so frustrated and distressed. I went to him and said, when am I going to have a spiritual awakening? And he said, do I look psychic? I have no idea when you're going to have a spiritual awakening. I guarantee you'll have one, but I don't know when. I said, but I'm 8 months sober and nothing's happened and AA's not working. And he looked at me, okay, I'll just let that one slide past. And he said, well, just keep doing what you're doing and see what happens, because when it happens, you will know it. And I said, well, it better happen, because, you know, I can't handle some wee small voice in the night, you know, the tiny voice of God. I need someone to lift me up by the lapel, slap me back and forth, and why need one of those who's your daddy gods, you know? Stupid moron, you know? And he said, just do what you're doing. I don't know how it's going to happen, but you'll know it, and you'll probably tell me about it. So I'm like, oh, nah, nah, nah. When he walked away. And so I kept doing what I was supposed to do. 2 weeks later, I'm mopping the floor at Ohio Street in West LA, because that's what the Irish are built for. And I'm standing there mopping the floor, and I paused for a second, leaned against the mop, and I looked at the people standing in line, and there were probably 100 people standing in line to thank the speaker, and I knew every single one of them by name, and I liked them. And it hit me. It hit me like something coursing through my whole body. It was the same kind of message I got from that day when I was at the meditation retreat and wanted to die and got a message that I was loved. And I didn't know where that came from. I didn't know where this came from. It just kind of bit me around the right way. And I went home from that meeting that night and I called Bill and I told him what happened. And he said, you know what, you had a moment of grace. You had a moment of grace. You can't earn it. It will come to you from a power bigger than you are, but you just have to keep doing what you're doing. And I've had so many moments of grace over the last 43 years of doing this. I wound up becoming a teacher when I was about three. I started going back to church with my sponsor, and because he was Catholic, and I had to make amends to the Catholic Church. That's a big amends. On my amends list, it was the Roman Catholic Church, and then the Internal Revenue Service underneath that. And then about 16 ex-girlfriends, you know, and I'm kidding, I never was that lucky, but I say two. And I wound up getting married to a woman. We had two children together. We shouldn't have had two dates, honestly. And it was a catastrophic marriage. And I had these two children, and to say no more than this, I got awarded their full custody by the court. And I was raising these children. I remarried, and their stepmother was great with them, and it was hard, but it was less hard because they had a good stepmother who loved them. And my life seemed to be going along fine. I got a job and a career that I could never have dreamed of. Doing something I only could have wished could have happened. I wound up writing cartoons, of all things, and loved writing for these characters. I met some of my idols doing it, and then I started to age out of the business, and my son and daughter were growing up and they were in high school, and my son had just graduated from high school, and he had a serious brain injury in football and had to have brain surgery. And then about 2 years later, he was at home, and my wife at the time came outside out in the patio where I was working, and she said, you know, you gotta get in here, Daniel. There's something wrong with Daniel. I came in the house and he was convulsing on the floor of his bedroom. He had foam coming out of his mouth, he was purple. And there was a bowl of crushed up drugs with a spoon in it. He had taken apparently like 60 over-the-counter Benadryls. He ground them up and then just swallowed them all. And he'd broken up with his girlfriend and he didn't want to live anymore. And so I remember getting on the floor and calling 911, and the 911 operator came on and she said, you know, what's happening? I told her, and she said, you have to start giving him CPR. Do you know how to give CPR? And I said, yeah. She said, okay, start CPR. And I sat there on the floor with him, and I looked at my hands, and I said, I forgot how to do CPR. I completely forgot how to do CPR. And she said, just stay on the line with me. I'm going to walk you through this. She took me step by step through doing CPR, and I did what I was told. That's what you get. Newcomers learn to follow direction. And I did that. And eventually the police showed up, the ambulance showed up, the paramedics showed up, and they got him, and he was stabilized, and he's fine today. He's a good boy. He's 25 now, and he's a strong, good kid with a good mind, and he's lovely, lovely human. He loves Barbara too. And I'm finishing quickly. Because some of you may have blocks to drive home. And and so when that happened, he was in the hospital. He was in intensive care for 4 days before they shipped him off to a nut house down in Torrance, and he was there for a week. And we thought we'd lost him. You know, he wasn't coming out of this state. He was not unconscious, and he was not present. He just stared at the walls, stared at everything, and never slept. And we thought he was finished, and he was, and he came out of it. And all the time, I was thinking, I don't have any contact with a higher power. Because while all this was happening, I was trying to find some comfort there, and I couldn't find it anywhere. I called my sponsor, and Bob said, well, we've got a prayer chain going up here with all the guys, my guys I sponsor, and a bunch of other people are praying for Daniel, so leave that, and you just take care of your son. Just go be with your son. And it took me a few days sitting around feeling sorry for myself that I'm a big phony, and I don't have a relationship with a higher power, because when that happened, I couldn't find it. And I didn't realize until days afterward that woman that was on the 911 line was someone who was an agent of that power. She didn't know it. She was just doing what she does. The paramedics were agents of that higher power doing what they do. The doctors that took care of him did what they do. They're all agents of that power that's bigger than I am. And I couldn't see it. And you can't see it sometimes when you're there. You have to have just faith that it is there. I just can't see it. It's like I can't do CPR, but if somebody shows me how to do it, I can do it. And I've taken up, I ran into some financial difficulties last year, and ended up building. They were all my fault. They were not like it was imposed on me, but I wound up having to get help, and I wound up having to take a new job at 74 as a high school teacher. Which is a lot like facing a firing squad every day. And the world has changed some since 1989, when the last time was that I taught in a classroom. And it's been difficult. And Barbara will tell you, you know, some days I just don't know what I'm doing. It's overwhelming. And I've got 180 kids every day, teenagers. The bell rings and 40 of them leave, and then they're replaced by 40 more, yearning to be tamed. And at Christmas time, I was walking through Target. I had no money. I had no prospects. I was teaching this class. I didn't know what I was doing. And I just burst into tears in one of the aisles. I had to go to a separate aisle and compose myself before I could even walk up to the cash register. And I thought, what's going on with me, you know? And sometimes you take on things in life that aren't very... As my friend Marilyn S., who's going to be speaking here next month, I guess, says, sometimes you take on things that you think you love and they're unrewarding. And there's a place for all of us there, too, because I had nothing but support from people to do this. And the point is, I do it. I was told when I was new, when I first started teaching, my sponsor said, you don't have to do this. I hear they're like animals. I hear that they will eat you alive in the class. I hear that they will make you wish you had never thought of being a teacher. And you have my permission to walk away from this right now if you want to, before you go in there. Or you can go in there and do it, and maybe find out that you shouldn't have been a teacher. And maybe you should never have even thought of being a teacher. Or you can walk away, and you can wonder till you're 70 years old whether you could have cut it or not. How do you want to live your life? And that's what I've chosen to do, because of the help of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, because of a higher power I've found, because of sponsorship, and because just of the people I know, like seeing my friends that I haven't seen for a long time. I know there's something good in here that I have to be a part of. Not just this, but being a part of. And I hope if you're new tonight, and if you've heard anything, that you'll come back tomorrow night and listen to somebody else and talk to people and give them your phone number and join us, because when the world starts spinning around, you're going to bump into a lot of us on your way out, and we will hold you in. Thank you.
round of applause.